there's been a pretty significant level of attack on Palestinian solidarity organizing. So I also want to express my admiration, really, for those students and organizers at Concordia who, through the last few months, have kept their head high and have fought back in a really dignified fashion. People like Nidal and Layla with SPHR, people like Sabine with the CSU, Sabine who gets it from all sides, who in the last few months have undertaken a real struggle to stand up for these issues and have done really well. So I just wanted to express my admiration for that. This event is called Band at Concordia. It has to be held at McGill because I can't speak at Concordia. And I was banned from Concordia without any sort of due process, without any hearing, because I was on the escalator, like Shira and like others, like Layla and others, on September 9th, protesting against Benjamin Netanyahu. It's not as if I was hiding the fact that I was on the escalator that day or afterwards. And 4 days afterwards, I wrote an article that appeared in a national newspaper basically saying that I was there and defending what I did. It's not simply defending being there. I'm not ashamed at all. I'm actually proud to have been on that escalator. I'm proud to have been with a microcosm, what was a microcosm of a social justice movement. Arab students and Palestinian students that were standing up for their rights with their allies, their Jewish allies, people in the social justice movement. I'm proud to have been there. I'm proud to have been there also where people stood up to a man who's made his reputation putting down Palestinians. Stood up to a man who at the time was running on a platform that basically asserted that Ariel Sharon was too soft on the Palestinians. And this man comes to Montreal and is shown his place as people stand up for their own dignity. And I'm proud to have been there. There's, of course, a lot of disinformation, a whole smear campaign that started literally minutes after this had happened, when Netanyahu gave his press conference and compared us to followers of bin Laden and Saddam Hussein, et cetera, et cetera. So I want to just briefly address some of that, that somehow we're opponents of free speech, we're violent, and we're anti-Semites. Opponents of free speech. Well, since the beginning of the Second Intifada, Concordia and Montreal in general has been a model of free speech. It's been a model of people who are tireless organizers, organizing displays and exhibitions and speakers and debates. It's been tireless. This is what really bothers people who apologize for the occupation. And these have been models of free speech, where there's debate, where there are open mics, where we yell at each other, where we disagree, etc., etc. And then you had the Netanyahu event, where suddenly you had new rules, what I call the Netanyahu rules, which were you shut off the university, which were that you have a pre-selected audience. This all happening on a campus where people can't normally go about their business like they would every other day. And somehow we're the opponents of free speech by opposing that basically rally that was supposed to be held, a pro-Israeli rally that was supposed to be held for Benjamin Netanyahu. Of course, there's the double standard on free speech as well, because a year before, SPHR had asked permission, nicely asked permission, to have a space so that they can do a bazaar, an open-air market. And they were refused. They were refused for security reasons because there would be too many people and the security couldn't handle it. Then you fast forward 1 year to the Netanyahu speech, and again, you have the Netanyahu rules, because having a couple of thousand people outdoors, you know, buying Arab food and checking out information, that's a security risk. But then a year later, you can have, on the busiest day of the school year, you can have snipers on rooftops, you can bring in riot police and police dogs, and you can shut off the campus, a huge building, and force people to go in through just one door, and that's okay. And that's standing up for free speech. It's just ludicrous, and we really have to expose these arguments. The second is that somehow we're violent people, that we were being violent. First of all, you know, I've been to protests where people prepare with gas masks and bandanas and padding. They're getting prepared because the police might respond in some way or another. At the protest against Netanyahu, there wasn't any gas masks or any of that. People entered the building that they enter every single day, except this time they had to do it through a side entrance or go through Java U. And they had to go through security guards who were saying, you can't go there, and stand on the escalator that they're able to stand on every single day. If you look at the videotape, if you talk to people who were there, you will see really clearly that there was no violence on that escalator. There were people who were chanting and singing. There were some very passionate speeches given about what Netanyahu's record was all about. The violence starts when the police and security decided that for this event to go on, for Netanyahu to give his propaganda rally to a pre-selected audience, they have to clear the escalator. Otherwise, he won't come in. And then they were proceeding to beat people as they cleared the escalator. And this violent crowd began to throw newspapers. I mean, I saw people, members of the NDP, people, you know, who aren't necessarily these so-called radicals, throwing newspapers saying, look, stop beating Aaron. You know, stop beating these people who are in the front, who are getting beat up. And that's where the glass breaks outside. Somehow we planned all of this. We had a walkie-talkie inside, a walkie-talkie outside. It was like, break the glass. And of course, that's not what happened. People outside were outraged at what's going on. The glass breaks and you have gas. And yes, people threw furniture and people threw other things after all that had happened. But we didn't go into this planning to be violent. And the people who are being accused, people who are being banned, aren't being accused of anything violent. And finally, this idea that we're anti-Semitic. This is particularly pernicious because when you start accusing members of a social justice movement who hold as a core value, not something on the side because it looks good to say, you know, you're against anti-Semitism. No, a core value. We're opposed to anti-Semitism because it affects us all. Because if you're apologizing for anti-Semitism, then you're apologizing for racism, which affects me, I'm sorry, and it affects other people. So this is a core value. When you start accusing people who hold this as a core value of being anti-Semitic, that term, which is an important term, which is meaningful, which exists today, has no meaning at all anymore. That's just pernicious. Now, of course, there were intolerant things that were said and done on September 9th. There are Jewish people who claim, and I don't deny, I'm not going to deny their claim, that they were called names. There were Arabs who were called names. I mean, I'm not Arab, but I was called a dirty Arab and a savage, you know, which goes to show that racists don't practice cultural sensitivity. in any case, there were intolerant things that were said and done. Not by organizers who were opposed to that, but there were intolerant things said and done in the midst of this commotion. That doesn't make what happened anti-Semitic, and it certainly doesn't make us anti-Semitic. And of course, now we have this witch hunt. They're looking for ringleaders, because this couldn't have happened because Shira and Nidal and Layla and Sabine and dozens and hundreds of other people think for themselves and decided to protest. Of course not. You need ringleaders. And as Sabine referred to, Frederick Lowy, the rector at Concordia, gave a speech where, this is several months afterwards, where he talks about the anarchists who were the ringleaders. They came from Guelph. It's not just the anarchists, but the anarchists from Guelph, Ontario, this hotbed where they have an agricultural school and anarchists. And they came to Montreal and made an alliance with the Palestinian aggressors. That's the term he used, the aggressors, to create all this. There's other scapegoating going on, of course. Scapegoating of Arabs, Arab men, people like Nidal. Scapegoating of people who are outspoken, who are passionate, and who are able to articulate these views very well. People like Samer Latrash, who's been particularly scapegoated, who's facing, he won an appeal, who's facing another hearing in a few days. I remember being outside talking to Raphael Lalouz and Solly Zeidel. Raphael's with B'nai B'rith. Solly Zeidel's a famous, a well-known politician, a supporter of Israel. And we're talking and arguing. I'm showing them the Netanyahu arrest warrant. And Samer's on the mic, and they're suddenly really concerned. And they're not concerned because Samer is saying, because he didn't say, you know, get your rocks ready or put on the belts, let's go, let's do like we do in Palestine. No, Samer was giving a really articulate, passionate, and funny speech about what was happening. And that really bothered them. And it does bother them to this day. People like Samer who speak out, people like Laith who speak out, anyone who speaks out. And that's why they're being scapegoated. So that's what I wanted to say about September 9th and its aftermath. I'm banned from Concordia, but you know, if I was going to go to university, I was going to go to McGill anyway, so not a big deal. It is a big deal, but I mean, we'll deal with it, and we are dealing with it. But you know, I've been privileged to be part of this solidarity movement for reasons I mentioned. It's part of social justice work. It's part of making links to, as Shira was mentioning, struggles for Native self-determination here. I've worked on the issue of East Timor, and Chiapas, et cetera, et cetera. And an opportunity presented itself to me this past November and December to be able to go to Palestine like Shira did and participate with a group called the International Solidarity Movement. I want to talk about that for a bit. The ISM is a group of Palestinians, led by Palestinians in Palestine, but made up of Palestinians with internationals that is involved in nonviolent direct action against the occupation, the Israeli occupation of Palestinian territories. It began several months after the beginning of the Second Intifada in September of 2000. The ISM, while privileging and while engaging in nonviolent direct action organized by Palestinians, while doing so, acknowledges the right and legitimacy of the armed struggle of Palestinians to resist the occupation. An armed struggle, by the way, recognized in international law. You have the right to resist your occupier. But the ISM as a group privileges direct action. It does so coming out of an analysis of civil resistance or mass resistance, an analysis of the First Intifada and the Second Intifada. The First Intifada, which began in the late 1980s, which was a popular uprising. That's what Intifada means, a popular uprising. An uprising not made up of just a few segments of the population or a select group of people, but masses of people, women and men, school kids, older people, who all took to the streets en masse, who all at that time resisted the occupation. If the Israeli authorities were going to shut down a school, the school would be opened up. If they came back, there would be kids there throwing rocks at soldiers. If a curfew was imposed, people would come out of their homes and disobey the curfew. There were famous incidents all over Palestine during that time. This put the issue on the map like it had never been put on before. At the time, you had Yitzhak Rabin, who would go on to win the Nobel Peace Prize, who at the time was responsible for the clampdown of the Intifada, who had the policy of broken bones. He ordered that the bones of rock throwers be broken. There were famous images of 16, 17-year-old men who were having their bones broken by Israeli soldiers. You had the use of tear gas, etc., etc. But this was a genuine popular uprising. People were putting the occupation in question. We're trying to undermine the tools of occupation, which means curfews, which means checkpoints, which means, and the occupier dictating how you will live your life and standing up to that. Now, the Second Intifada began also as a popular uprising when Ariel Sharon made his wise decision to visit the Al-Aqsa Mosque and basically spit in the face of Palestinian popular opinion. This was permitted, by the way, by Ehud Barak, that other great proponent of peace in Israel. At the beginning of the Intifada, you had thousands that took to the streets again, took to the towns and villages all over Palestine. And during those first few months, before there were any suicide bombings or any armed attacks, you had over 300 civilian deaths. And this Intifada became very quickly an Intifada of armed struggle, an Intifada of attacks by groups like Hamas and Jihad and PFLP and others. And lost that more popular, meaning the active participation of large segments of the population. So the ISM, with other groups, tries to rekindle that in the tradition of the First Intifada, in the tradition of the Arab Revolt of the 1930s, which can maybe be looked at as the real First Intifada, when there was a general strike by Arabs in Palestine against British rule. So the ISM has been engaged in a lot of campaigns in its short history, in its three-year history. For example, the Olive Harvest Campaign, where it lends support to Palestinians who are trying to harvest olives, which protects olive trees, which are being bulldozed and being uprooted as the Israelis build more settlements and build more bypass roads. These olive trees, Palestinians can talk about this much better than I can, but you know, this is crucial to Palestinian culture as a source of food, as an important symbol. There's the Right to Education campaign that the ISM is part of, where universities are being closed down and ISM activists working with Palestinians are trying to open up those schools in defiance of the occupation. The premise here is that internationals, people coming from abroad, will lend a certain profile, a certain security, a certain safety to these direct actions, which are an open defiance of the occupation. Crucially, the work of internationals isn't necessarily in Palestine. Internationals are encouraged to go there for a few weeks or a few months. Ashira went for 2 weeks. I went for about 6 weeks. But the work is here. The work is here as we participate in Palestinian solidarity work, but are able to use our short time there to support these direct actions, to support this undermining of the occupation through the use of, like I said, nonviolence. Now, what's been Israel's response? Well, first of all, there's been a measure of success of the ISM of ISM's activities. I saw this firsthand myself. I saw the euphoria of people in Nablus this past January as they removed a roadblock within their city. a roadblock. You know, it's not like roadblocks in Montreal where the police put up these, you know, little dinky metal fences and you can just throw them away. This is earth being dug up. Earth being dug up so people can't move from one place to another. They just can't move, especially older people. But you just can't get between two parts of the city, and basically cut off Balata, the refugee camp, from Nablus. And this roadblock had been there ever since Operation Defensive Shield. And in January, Palestinian activists called on ISM to be there, and they proceeded to remove this roadblock. And it was euphoric as these 200 to 300 people removed the roadblock. I saw that firsthand. So the ISM's work has been, there's been a measure of success. We can talk about other examples of homes that haven't been bulldozed, protection that's been given to Palestinians as they deliver food to refugee camps, etc., etc. But recently there's been a full-scale attack on the activities of the ISM. For example, ISM activists like Rachel Corey, she was murdered. 23-year-old American, she was murdered. Thomas Herndahl was murdered. He's on life support, but he's brain dead. Brian Avery, another ISM activist, was shot in the face. His face was basically shot off, and he needs a significant amount of plastic surgery just to restore having a face, let alone a face that... Anyways. These are all things that have happened within the last few months, since March. Of course, dozens and dozens of Palestinians are dying every single day. But there's a tremendous message that's being sent by the Israeli army here. A message that I'm sure Palestinians know, but I mean, we have to be reminded, those of us who are working as a solidarity movement. The message is, of course, if you fight back, we're going to kill you. If you engage in nonviolent direct action, we're going to kill you. And if you do nothing, we're going to kill you. I mean, that's the message that's being sent. Because every single day, as Shiro was mentioning, there's a dozen dead in Gaza yesterday, including a 12-year-old boy. When I was there, during the so-called period of calm, there were 50 Palestinian civilians that were killed, including, again, a 10-year-old girl and another 12-year-old boy. I want to mention one thing about the death of Rachel Corey, because it's true. The death of an American will provoke more sympathy for a variety of reasons in the West than the death of anonymous Palestinians every single day. After Rachel Corey after she was murdered, her body was on the way back to the United States. In Gaza, where she was murdered, there was a mock funeral, a funeral held for her without her body, which was attended by over 1,000 people in Gaza. Her photo is now up all over Rafah, along with other martyrs and other shaheeds. The casket that they used was draped with the American flag. You know, the Palestinians are so dehumanized. After September 11th, they were supposedly clapping and cheering for the deaths of Americans. And now in Gaza, which is, you know, where the worst of the worst are supposed to live, supposedly, you have thousands of them on the streets carrying a coffin with the American flag on it, which for them is a way of honoring her. I mean, I'm pretty sure Rachel, who's from Oregon, was an anarchist, so she doesn't care, American flag. But still, that's the sentiment, you know. It goes to show you how you know, the feeling there. In any case, I should finish up here because there's another speaker. When I went to Palestine, I was part of a campaign. I talked about the olive harvest and the right to education. I was a part of a campaign called Prisons in Our Own Land, the Wall of Apartheid, which makes reference to the building of the so-called security fence. The security fence, by the way, which is being built despite this so-called roadmap to peace that George Bush and others have put together for the Palestinians and the Israelis. This security fence, which is essentially a wall, which is going to be 360 kilometers long, 8 meters high, surrounded on either side by trenches, towers every kilometer, that's going to seal off the West Bank and seal off Gaza from Israel itself. It makes the Berlin Wall look like nothing. Not only is it going to seal off the West Bank and Gaza, but because of how it's being built, that is within the Green Line, within the territory recognized as the occupied territories, it's going to effectively confiscate 10% of the West Bank land. This is a land grab. This is a perfect example of what people mean by ethnic cleansing and by expulsion. This is a clear example happening as we speak. That 10% of land, by the way, isn't arbitrary. It isn't just chosen, you know, oh, let's just choose this 10%. It happens to be some of the most fertile land in Palestine, in the part of Palestine that's occupied, and it's an important source of water. The area around Qaqilia and Tukaram, which is a highland area, which is an important source of water. You have a village, for example, Al-Daba, made up, which is comprised of 200 Palestinians. It has one school that happens to find itself on the other side of the wall. And those people have been ordered by the military official in the area to leave. Again, comparable to what happened in Kosovo. comparable to incidences of ethnic cleansing that we read about historically, but it's happening now. In general, the Prisoners in Our Own Land Wall of Apartheid campaign makes reference to all the barriers to movement, all the barriers to basic dignity that are put up in the way of Palestinians, that is just a part of what occupation is about. In Bethlehem, for example, the security fence that's being built just in Bethlehem, where the suburbs of Bethlehem have now been annexed to Jerusalem, another land grab because of the way the fence is being built. In Gaza, homes being destroyed so that this fence can be built. When Rachel Corrie was murdered, she was standing up with a red jacket, clearly identified, in front of the bulldozer, asking it to stop so that this home wouldn't be bulldozed, which wasn't being bulldozed because it's the home of a suicide bomber. It was being bulldozed because it was in the way of the building of this fence. In Nablus, road blockades, etc., etc. All the things that are used to make an occupation happen, checkpoints, curfews, the day-to-day humiliation of Palestinians. When I was there, and I was there again in December and January, I was there during a so-called period of calm. Those periods of calm, by the way, are between suicide bombings, because when there's a suicide bombing, that's when things are really hot. The whole media reports on the suicide bombing. Then there's a period of calm, which means there aren't Israelis dying, there are Palestinians dying. So that's calm. And there were over 50 Palestinian civilians, as I mentioned, that were killed. And then there was a suicide bombing in Tel Aviv in January, just a few days before I left. That was a few months ago. It's gotten worse, so much worse now. And it's worse in two ways. It's worse because of the level of killing. And it's worse because there's absolutely no attention being paid to it. But I was there during a so-called period of calm. And I spent most of my time in Beit Sahour and in Nablus. Beit Sahour, which is an ISM town, ISM headquarters, just near Bethlehem, and Nablus, which is the main town in the West Bank. I spent a week in Beit Sahour, sort of taking it easy because I thought I was taking it easy, but taking it easy because I wasn't supposed to enter the West Bank. When I entered Israel at Ben Gurion Airport, I was supposed to be deported. I refused. I was eventually allowed to stay, but I wasn't allowed to enter the West Bank or Gaza, and I did, because my position at the time was it's not for Israelis to decide who enters Palestine, it's for Palestinians to decide. And when I phoned up the ISM, they said, of course you should come. You should come more than ever. By the way, now the Israelis are generalizing that policy. I mean, there have been hundreds of people who've been turned away, but according to an article in Haaretz, which Stefan referred to in the opening, they're now going to expel all activists with the ISM. So these eyes that are there that can observe what's happening aren't going to be allowed to be there anymore. And they're using the recent suicide bombing as an excuse because those suicide bombers had British passports. Well, there have been suicide bombers that have had Israeli passports. I mean, are you going to expel them? Maybe they should. All Israelis with Israeli passports. In any case, I was in Beit Sahour for a week working out of the ISM's media office where I got a glimpse during this period of calm before things got much worse as they are now. Basically taking calls and writing reports from ISM activists on the ground in Gaza, in Qalqilia, in Nablus, elsewhere, who phone in or come by the office and report at what they're seeing. For example, I got a call from a Swedish activist named Henrik, who, when he phoned me, had literally seconds before fled a house that collapsed, almost collapsed on him because it was shot with a tank shell in Gaza. He was in that home with other internationals trying to lend protection to Palestinians whose homes were slated for demolition because it was in the line of where the security fence was supposed to be built. When I'm taking this call, I get another call on the landline from a woman named Roba, who's a Palestinian who is up in Qalqilia, who is basically standing in front of Israeli soldiers as they're shooting rubber bullets at students who are throwing rocks at soldiers. And I'm trying to make these reports. And this would happen literally on the hour. And not just from ISM activists, from others. This is just day-to-day reality of occupation and day-to-day reality of resisting the occupation nonviolently. That's what I was hearing about. And, of course, what I would observe later when I went to Nablus and saw for myself. I've taken up a lot of time, so I'm not going to talk about Nablus. I'm just going to end by just mentioning a few things. I guess one thing to mention is the key point here to keep in mind, and the one thing that I learned, I mean, I had some appreciation of it beforehand, but you really appreciate when you see it for yourself is what's happening in Palestine is Palestinians aren't being punished for what they do. They're being punished for who they are. They're being punished for being Palestinian and for continuing to live in that land and trying to live with some basic dignity. Forget about fighting back. I mean, they have the right to fight back, but living with basic dignity. What you have is the practice of collective punishment, punishing an entire population for who they are, not for what they've done. Collective punishment, by the way, that was owned to a fine art by the English and the French when they had their colonies. A lot of people like to compare the Israeli occupation of Palestine to the Nazis. I don't, because I think comparing it to English and French colonizers is an insult enough. The French and the British, or the French in Algeria, say, or the British in India, if an Indian, say, in Chandigarh or in Lahore, would talk back to his British boss, or would, heaven forbid, maybe stab a British soldier, a British occupier, the entire village would be punished. The entire village would be under curfew. All the men would be pulled out and beaten, or worse, as a statement to these savage Indians or these savage Algerians. That's collective punishment, and that's what's practiced on Palestinians all the time. They're being punished for who they are. We have to understand that colonial reality, because if we don't understand that colonial reality, we get into all these dead-end debates about these two sides who hate each other. Well, yes, there's hatred that's being bred, but it's not about two sides that hate each other. It's about a colonial situation, and that situation one identifies with the colonized who fights against the colonizer. There's the issue of violence that I want to talk about as well, and nonviolence. As I mentioned, ISM is a nonviolent movement. That doesn't mean it stands in judgment of people who are engaged in the armed struggle. There's the recognition that people have the right to fight back. The point I want to make, though, is the frustration that I heard expressed by Palestinians that I talked to about how many in the West say you should be like Gandhi, you should be like Martin Luther King. And maybe if you're like Gandhi and you're like Martin Luther King, the world will be sympathetic to you and you'll win. It's that easy. Well, the fact is, as we've seen, when Palestinians practice nonviolence, which they practice every single day, because it's not difficult to practice nonviolent direct action in Palestine. Here in the West, you know, it's a big deal. You know, we got to plan, we got to get the medics ready, the legal support ready, plan everything out. Well, in Palestine, walking out of your house during curfew is a form of direct action. Going to school when it's closed down is a form of direct action. Trying to get from Ramallah to a nearby town, getting through checkpoints, those are all forms of direct action. Removing a roadblock with 200 of your fellow citizens, those are all forms of direct action. And that's being practiced every single day. And the response is murder. The response is attacks. The response is to take away those eyes, those international eyes that might be part of it, which is what Haaretz reported today. So the problem isn't with Palestinians being violent or nonviolent. The problem is with us in the West. The problem is with us who are part of a solidarity movement and our support and making sure that we're providing that support, making sure that we're exposing what's going on here, which is where our struggle is. So I think that's crucial. And I guess end with the word of solidarity, because ISM is, it's built into our name, International Solidarity Movement. It's not solidarity as often practiced or talked about by, some NGOs about helping other people, those poor Palestinians, those poor kids, we want to help them. No, I mean, it's understanding solidarity as being a shared struggle. Our struggle is here. Of course, what's happening at Concordia is not in any way comparable to what's happening in Palestine. But there is a struggle there. It's a struggle standing up for social justice because of people like Nidal, like Layla, like Samer, like Shadi, like Laith, like Noor, like other Palestinian students who are here for whatever reason, because they're refugees or because they're trying to improve their lives, and are not going to forget where they come from and are being attacked for who they are. So solidarity isn't about helping them. It's about sharing that struggle. And it's about understanding that no one is free until we're all free, and we should act accordingly. Thank you.